To return to mythology.
This business of mythology is all but dropped out, but I wonder if any of you are aware that there is a little pocket in the Near East where, in effect, the ancient mythology of Bible times still, in effect, survives in some of the mountainous areas, in spite of course, you know, the Christianization that went through the area after the time of Christ, and in spite, of course, of the Muslim and Mohammedan invasion that went through in the 7th century A.D., by some of the little mountain pockets of northern Syria, still, by they've been isolated enough that they're able to maintain themselves. In fact, the present premier of Syria, Hafez Assad, who's in the news all the time these days, comes from that little sect. He's not a Muslim. The papers often refer to him as a Muslim, or the group as another Muslim sect. And of course, you know, most of those newspaper men wouldn't know mythology from any other kind of religion. So they call him, but he comes from that little group, and the name of this group, you'll find various spellings of it, is the Alawites. But basically, this is the ancient Syrian biblical paganism that still lives on there. It's not a monotheistic religion at all. One of those things that is really just been learned about recently that probably should be exploited and developed quite a bit more.
You talk about mythology. What do you mean?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going into that. I'll try to answer that as we go on. Yeah. Right. But my only point right now is that for the most part, you know, everybody's in your boat. It's ancient history to us, and even Bible scholars could only sort of guess, you know, from what the Bible was against, you know, how it behaved, you know, looking at itself. And with archaeology now, we see the picture a little bit more clearly and a little bit more as we go on. Well, anyway, we ought to start asking ourselves, just what do we understand by mythology? The word means a lot of things. Sometimes it's used in a lot of different ways. It's a little confusing. We don't have to go into all of that tonight. Myth. And does myth mean the same thing as mythology? For our purposes tonight, I think we'll say yes and leave it at that. I think if I ask you a question like that, what do you think of when I say myth or mythology? I think the ordinary answer would probably be, you know, stories that aren't true, right? Something like fable, fairy tale, not essentially different from those words. Right? I think in one sense, of course, that's very true. I mean, obviously, this is not the true religion. It's not true. It's not revealed. So, I mean, in one sense, of course, to leave it with that is not wrong. But I think one has to stress in a way that's just a negative definition. And it doesn't really help us understand, you know, how it was from the inside or why it was such competition for the biblical world. If it were self-evidently untrue, fairy tales, why, that wouldn't attract so many people. And there wouldn't have been that knock-down, drag-out struggle, you know, with the times of almost looking like the true religion was going to go under. Remember even Elijah, you know, complaining that he alone is left. And, well, the 7,000 were, but still, you know, 7,000 was, in another sense, only 7,000, too. So, you know, that just illustrates how strong the battle was. But I think what I want to stress in the first place, remember last time we defined archaeology as having that word logi in the last part of it. But the archaeology means a certain logic, a certain story of the past. And in mythology, too, there's that logi in the last part. That is to say, mythology is a kind of logi. It's a kind of theology. It's a pattern of thinking. You know, it's a whole worldview, you know, something like Christianity. You know, you can divide it up, a bunch of doctrines. Christians believe this and that, but in another sense, Christianity is your whole outlook on life. What makes everything add up? You know, how you get it all together, as they say these days, and so on. And mythology was another one, if not our kind of logic. And that's what makes it hard for us to even get on the inside of it a lot of times. But it is a kind of logic. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of, you know, of putting things together, of interpreting life, of answering the basic questions of why we're here and, you know, what we're here for. And all, of course, again, they're not the biblical answers. They're not the true answers, but, you know, they were man's own attempts to answer those kind of questions. So what basically was at the root of mythology? What is the ground idea that made it tick? And in a way, what made all of the mythologies ultimately the same, even though the names varied from place to place, and even though the stories, you know, would vary a little bit on the surface? Well, yeah.
When you talk about mythology, are you talking about all these other religions other than Christian, mostly?
Yes. Basically, of the countries that I have listed here, although much of it one could go on and talk on a pretty worldwide basis. You know, I'm concerned here only, of course, with the relatively near neighbors, of course, of the biblical world. But one could extend that, you know, to Indian religion, to American Indian religion. Obviously, the further you go, the more differences there are in detail. But all the mythologies tend to have an awful lot in common. And I think what I want to say next would pretty well hold true of all of them. I think the basic root idea of mythology, and in a way the basic idea that separates it from Christianity, is, as I would put it, that it proceeds from the idea of personification of nature. That God is not a person, or the gods are not really persons, although they're talked about that way, of course. But they are really just personifications. That is, they are natural phenomena described as though they were alive. And so you've got the wind god, who really is just the wind, you know, written up as though he were alive. The sun god, you see, who really is just the sun. The sun god is not something separate from the sun. He is the sun. Just, you know, describe, you know, see, we're so used to thinking of the sun with our scientific categories, you know, and all the kind of questions that we answer, but, you see, they, of course, knew nothing of science, and so the sun is personified. And see, and then that's not just stories. They really, really thought of it that way. And so there was the moon god and all the others, and the very fact that we can line them up with nature on down the line a little bit as these major ones under aspect indicate that. You see, heaven. There was a god who was heaven. Not just, you know, he was, not merely that he was in heaven. Maybe that was true too, but he was heaven. And earth. There was another god who was the earth. You see, he thought of it as alive. And here I'd like to make the point, you know, we use the expression Mother Earth a lot, don't we? Good old Mother Earth, or Mother Nature, or those kind of expressions. I think we stop to think this is really about as pagan a language as can be. I don't think we're all that serious, of course, when we talk that way. But sometimes we come close to it, you know, almost with a kind of a fatalism, you know, that just the way everything is, and you're just caught up in a big ball and carried along with it. You know, if we're not careful, why, that can, in practice, I think, contradict much of what we say in Christianity. But at any rate, that expression is very close to what, of course, mythology took more seriously. And so all the rest, storm, fertility, the whole aspect of the sexuality of all of existence, you know, that finally keeps life going, that, of course, was again personified, and wisdom, underworld, grain. So I just listed major ones here, of course. You could go on with that list. That's great, length. So I think as much as you can reduce it to one formula, I would say it's person versus personification. You know, we say that so much about Christianity that we almost forget about how radical, in one sense, an idea it is if you compare Christianity to religions in general. That we have a personal God, you know, a personal Savior, that you have to have personal faith in Him and so on. You know, we talk that way all the time. But we aren't threatened as immediately by mythology as they were, that we forget, you know, what we're really saying. Although I think in another sense, I've seen polls of what a lot of college students allegedly believe.
Do they really believe that there's a personal God? Or is God just a name, you see, for life, for whatever it will go on somewhere? And the polls are not terribly reassuring. You know, the polls are quite high that today, you know, college students don't, you know, think of a sun as a sun god. They don't, you know, develop it that way. But departing from this basic Christian idea that God is a person, you see, who's separate from everything that he made. The difference between the creator and the creation. You see, in mythology, there is no difference between those two. The creator is the creation. Another name for it. But a lot of our college students, you know, I think, believe that.
And I think if you really could smoke out a lot of other people, the man on the street, you know, who never come to church,
you know, what do they really believe about God? There aren't very many people, of course, who are atheists. You have quite people who obviously, you know, own up to that. But what do they really believe about God? Oh, you know, it's some force, you know, out there in a general way. It's not all that different from mythology and pagan, as one might think.
And I think it should be stressed this difference, even today, and of course in the Bible world over against mythology, this difference between the idea of a personal God versus a mere personification of the sun or the moon or the stars, whatever it was, that this is more at the heart of what makes Christianity unique than what we often say it is, namely that there is only one God. Now, of course, that's certainly true too. But there are other religions that believe in one God. You know, Christianity is not the only religion that believes in only one God, not by a long shot. So that in a way, whether that God, one or many, is, you know, before and outside of everything that he made, or whether he's just a name for it, I think that is closer to the very, very center of what really makes Christianity Christianity.
And, you know, if you think that through, it's only that kind of a God who finally could become man, could become a person, Jesus Christ, and all the rest, if you move on deeper into Christianity. So, you know, what does that mean about the pagan mythology then? If you follow out their way of thinking, you see, if the gods are all just, you know, names for parts of nature, that means that the gods themselves are subject to the laws of nature. They have to do certain things like nature does. Greens up in the spring and dies in the winter. It rains when there's the right combination of circumstances. And it doesn't rain when the right front doesn't come through or whatever it is. Because they didn't know those scientific explanations. I'm not sure we do either about the weather, for that matter. But even so, I see the gods are there's a power above the gods themselves. See, the gods are part of the constant change, the constant flux of everything. And the gods die. Maybe some of them do, you know, like nature dies, or part of it does, as the leaves fall off the tree. And, you know, when you say that, you can see how different this is from the biblical idea of God, who, of course, cannot die. The very idea is a contradiction in terms to talk about the true God that way. And that there is some law that God himself is bound to. You know, that makes no sense to our way of thinking. But I think that just, you know, illustrates the radical difference that is involved. But then why do they have many gods? Why is mythology usually polytheistic? Not always, as I said. You know, there are ancient as well as modern versions of this, the thought of only one God. But usually these are polytheistic. Well, why? Well, simply because of the almost infinite variety and multiplicity of nature. You know, there not only are all the things you see, the sun, the moon, more stars than you can count, and trees, and animals, all kinds of forces, but there are all kinds of things you can't really explain. I mean, even we can't with science. And so polytheism, you see, is an attempt to put into language, the unpredictability, the chaos, the constant change of nature, all the competing forces. You know, when a storm front comes through, well, you can see the gods fighting in the sky. You can see the black clouds fighting with the other clouds, or you know, whatever it is up there. And you see, they describe that in story terms. And again, it's not just story, you see, it's a way of describing what they saw going on. And I think this also is why pagan religion, from our standpoint, is we use the word amoral. Of course, from a Christian standpoint, we would say immoral too, ultimately. But more from their internal standpoint, they were just that they had no morals. You know, it's like talking about the barnyard rooster. You know, you don't call him immoral. You know, animals just aren't that way. This isn't the word you use. They're outside the boundaries of morality. That's the way nature is. You know, you can talk of morality only with persons, with people. So you see, if the gods are not persons, then that means that the gods are not really moral. They're as unpredictable as where the pollen, you know, from a tree happens to fall, and so on. One of my major illustrations of how radically different this is comes in the word holy. What does holy mean? We use it all the time. I think the catechism definition we learn is sinless. And hating sin, something like that, some kind of definition of that. And that applies, of course, to the biblical God very well. It describes holiness in terms of morals, if you will, basically. At least that's a good part of it. Although another part of holiness is that God is, once in a while we pun a little bit, holy means that God is wholly different, you know, wholly other. He's separate from man and from sinners. Now, merely to say that, you know, isn't to say in what way they're different. The Canaanite religion, the pagan religions, the mythologies talk to their gods as holy a lot too. Every bit as much as the Bible, you know, talks to the true God as holy. Their gods were wholly other in one sense. You see that they were not men, but they were not holy in the way in which our God is holy, that is, in the sense of morals, of ethics, because you know they weren't that type of God. They were different in another sense of merely being you know outside of the human orbit or something like that. And a good illustration of this is that the word that the Bible itself uses, and echoing what we know now from archaeology, for the sacral prostitutes. That, remember, came into the temple of Jerusalem whenever paganism invaded it. And remember, got tossed out with every reformation, but usually came right back in, you know, as soon as paganism went out again. Remember, the whole book of Kings is full of this, you know, back and forth struggle between the true religion and pagan and mythology. The biblical name for these, you know, for us to say a holy prostitute sounds like a contradiction on the face of it. You know, but this was their word for it. The biblical word for these is simply holy ones. How holy, you see. Holy only in the sense that they were not, you know, streetwalkers, if you will. But they were, you know, part of the religion. They served and represented the gods, but they were set apart. You see, they were wholly other, not in any moral sense, but in the sense of belonging to religion. What they earned went into the temple treasury and all that type of thing. But I think the use of this word, you see, illustrates in a way the radical difference between much of mythology and the Bible. In fact, one of the major sex or fertility goddesses of Canaan is repeatedly referred to as the Holy One. In fact, she's called that more than she's called by her name. And yet, you know, from a biblical, from a Christian standpoint, you know, if she was holy, well, it'd be hard to imagine what unholy might be. Yeah.
You don't mean that she's referred to the Bible
as you know, not that the Bible, of course, believed it in the way, of course, that the unbelievers did,
but that they were so used to this manner of speaking that they, you know, used the same name for them that that you know that the others did.
But it wasn't translated into English.
Oh no, no. Well, I think you can understand why.
Yeah.
Sure. We can you see in their day why the readers, you know, would understand that they were all too aware of that stuff. It didn't require any explanation. Of course, for us, why? We'll explain. And in general, one could say this is partly why fertility, sexuality plays such an important role in mythology, because, you know, obviously reproduction is what keeps the world going. Whether you're dealing with plants or animals or human beings or anything, you know, naturally, if there were no reproduction, why life would grind to a halt soon. So inevitably, you see, if you're personifying nature, if you're describing it in terms of stories, well, naturally, sexuality is going to be a major part of that. But you see, that was, you know, part of God himself. It was not something that God had made, you know, or so on, or something that, you know, might be abused by man. And all of that, again, we just would have to talk about it in a completely different way than we talk about those things within the Bible. Now, I think one other thing that should be stressed in this connection, then. If there really is no personal God who's separate from what he's made, that means that you really can't talk about creation in mythology. Because, you know, what's create mean? The definition we make something out of nothing, right? The very word creator implies, you know, somebody who's there before what he makes. And, of course, who is always different from it. And I think we have gotten, you know, so used to thinking that way that we have a hard time imagining that somebody, you know, else might think differently. Although you'd be surprised that there's a very popular heresy, I would say, in Christianity today that goes by the name of process thought, if you know that word at all. Quite popular, that I would say is basically the same type of thought today that tries to describe the Christian God, you know, in terms of change and process and development and so on. That, at least in the more philosophical level, why that's not as distant a thing as we, you know, might think it is, but I won't go into that here. But what I want to stress is that they're really, you know, we talk that way. We talk about the creationness of the other people. And we talk that way in a way because our language has become so Christianized that we don't really have any better word for it. We have to describe it, you know, in terms of what we're used to talking about. And the Christians are used to, of course, to talking about creation. But really, that's because of the poverty of our language. That you can't talk about creation in Babylonia or Canaan, you see, in the mythologies, because there was no creator who was there before it and who stayed outside of it. And what do you have instead, then? Well, instead, you have the eternity of matter. There just always was. You know, matter, stuff, here. In a way, like we say, God is eternal. They said, too, the gods were eternal, but that was just another way of saying that, you know, everything is eternal. It might change its outward form, of course, a little bit. But basically, you see, the physical universe and so on always had been and always would be there. That's why the creation stories, you check them, in any of these countries, what we call creation stories, nearly always they're simply a story of two primeval beings, usually the sky and the earth or something like that, male and female, who mated and had children. You see, that meant other gods, but that meant the development of the universe. You see, that's not really creation of making something out of nothing. It's just, you know, the external change of the form of the matter that was already there. It's no more real creation, of course, than when, you know, somebody has children today, unless we're using language a little bit loosely. And I think this is standard. It tended to be the sky thought of as male, that impregnated the earth, rained it, put seed into it,
And somehow then, you know, from that, you know, came all the other gods and so on. The details of the stories change, the names change a little bit, but the basic idea is very much the same. And if you will allow me, you know, I don't like to talk about all this stuff in public, don't misunderstand me, but, you know, some of this stuff is rather raunchy, rather obscene, but it's of the very nature of this stuff. Just as an illustration of how you can have only one God and yet certainly be no closer to Christianity, I think can be illustrated by these stories about how you know, everything always was that way. In Egypt, one of the stories we have, at least, for how everything began, does not have this common pattern of sky and earth making, of two, you know, eternal beings, but of simply one God who was there from all eternity. And once upon a time, that one God, you know, simply got bored and masturbated. And from his seed, you know, came all the other gods. Well, obviously, that's no improvement. That's, you know, no more moral than the others or anything. But you see, just as an illustration of the, and I think one has no trouble understanding then why the people of this religion were not particularly moral. You see, if the gods are certainly no better than man, and maybe a lot worse, depending on it. You see, not to speak of the whole Christian idea of judgment and grace. Obviously, you can't even talk in those kind of terms at all. You had a question, didn't you?
Yeah, I was thinking of what did these people think of when they thought of afterlife?
I want to go on with that a little bit in that direction. Maybe you can hold that a second, and if I don't answer it, I'll bring it up again, okay? What I did want to stress before I go into that, though, is how close this manner of thinking really is to evolution. That's why I like to make the point that in the struggle against evolution, the church today faces basically the same problem that you had in mythology. But, you know, it's not written up in terms of all these stories about gods, but the fundamental idea underneath is the same thing. What do you have in evolution? Not creation. I mean, that's where the fight is, of course. But you have the eternity of matter. There just always was that. You know, of course, it evolved. It changed its outward form. But it always was there, and it always will be there. You know, if you press them back far enough, you know, who knows how many billion years. Maybe they think there was a big bang once upon a time, but still something had a bang, you know. You can't get back, you see, to a time before there was anything with evolution. You have the same idea of the eternity of matter. And like some people have said that the two main gods of evolution are infinite time and chance. You know, just, you know, if in doubt, we'll add another billion years. And maybe within that time, why enough atoms or molecules might bump together, you know, and change the form or something. But the fundamental struggle, you see here, that there can't really be any God in evolution. If you talk about God, that's just in quotation marks. That's just a name for whatever it is that makes the world go round. It's just a name for, you know, what maybe bumping, maybe these two atoms bump together or whatever. And so on. So in many ways, I think this just illustrates how, you know, I think this is part of learning how to understand the Old Testament. Otherwise, you read, you know, the prophets fighting against Baal and, you know, all these other gods, and the modern reader, you know, thinks, what the heck, you know, I'm not tempted by Baal, you know, who is that anyway? That's nothing to me. That's ancient history, ancient religion. But I think once you learn how to translate, and to see that basically we just change the name, just change a few details. That, you know, the French have that saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I think once one learns that, why much of the Old Testament, you know, speaks to us today much more readily than it appears to otherwise, if one isn't aware of how very much the battle is still the same as it was in those days. Well, now, maybe to get at your question a little bit, what I said about the beginning of the world is also true about the end of the world. In mythology, you can't really talk about an end of the world any more than you can talk about a beginning. You see, just as in mythology, it always was there, so with evolution too, it always will be there. You know, it may blow up, but still, you know, it's going to be there in one form or another. I think that's what a lot of evolutionists think. You know, they think our world started with a big bang back there, and they have the idea of an infinitely expanding universe, and someday it'll expand so much that it'll you know, collapse and fall in on itself when it gets overextended. You'll have another big bang, you see, and then it'll all start over again. That's at least that's one, you know, evolutionary picture. Something like that in mythology, too. So you see, there can't really be any afterlife. Well, when you die, what happens? Well, basically, like the pagan idea today, you know, you return to the dust. That's all. You just become part of what you always were. Just like a tree, you know, the whole cycle of ecology. It rots and returns to the ground and, you know, fertilizes some other tree or plant, but it's just, you know.
We're buried with the things that they're going to have a boat to ride on.
Or yeah, well,
in eternity.
Yeah,
the Indians who thought that they were going to be a happy hunting ground.
Yeah, right. You particularly in Egypt, and of course the Indians in America, something like that too. And I don't know an awful lot about American Indian mythology, but I imagine it's also the same there too. But I know in Egypt, if you get behind those stories, well, the basic idea even there is that the pharaoh, after he dies, he will, you know, become part of nature again. They'll identify him with one of the stars up in the sky, and they can see their ancestors making the circuit in the night skies, that type of thing. So see, even there, they're describing it, you see, just in story form. They're describing really a natural process.
They're thinking about coming back to life in a different form.
Well, the Egyptians didn't really, you know, develop that. Of course, you know, some of the Indian religions did have that idea that you really would come back to life in the form of an animal or something. And if the Egyptians thought that at all, they didn't develop it. It was just that, you know, the body eventually decays and just becomes part of nature in some general sense. I don't think they. I think if you pushed them, they wouldn't have answered it much more than that. As in a way, how could one answer what would happen to you after you die? You know, without revelation. Eventually, why the body just, you know, disappears? If measures are not taken to preserve it. Of course, with the Egyptian religion, that's a little bit of a case by itself there, and one could pursue that at greater length if we had the time. But even though the Egyptians put more accent on this, no doubt, you know, in a certain temporary way, I mean, the overall picture, you know, does not change. Eventually, you just become part of the world all after life. One way of describing this, what describes the Bible or Christianity is a line. You know, it started at a certain date, and it will end at a certain date. We may not be absolutely sure of those dates, but that doesn't change the principle. And the basic motion is horizontal, you know, from beginning to end, with, of course, you know, Christ at the center. A whole Christian idea. What it's all about. Whereas with paganism, the basic idea is that of a circle. You know, no matter where you break in, eventually you come back to the starting point. Just like nature, you see summer and winter, day and night, death and life. It always returns. You don't have to worry that when the sun sets at night, it'll rise the next morning. You know, and so on. No doubt that the winter's coming now, but you know, the grass will come back next spring. So on. One man dies, but another one's born to take his place. The eternal circle. And the day, follow the universe that way too. In a way, something like the life of evolution too. You know, the Big Bang and the all starting over again. And, you know, well, what's that mean? Too, if everything's a circle, that means that finally your view on life is fatalistic. There's no possibility of really getting anywhere. Right? Because eventually you're just going to come back to where you started from. Whereas, you see, with Christianity, with individual life as well as with world history, you know, you came from somewhere and you're going somewhere for the goal that God has set and revealed in principle for you. But you see here, you know, if you'll pardon the expression, you know, just one damn thing after another, you know. Motion, activity, but going nowhere. But, you know, Shakespeare has that one line that I always like, that life is like a bit player in a play, that he comes on the stage, you know, speaks his couple of lines and then, you know, disappears and is seen no more. Sound and fury signifying nothing. You know, he makes a lot of noise for a second, but, you know, he's just a drop in the bucket and then the whole picture. So the insignificance of any individual life, see, in contrast to Christianity, where each individual, you know, has a soul and a destiny and all the rest, and of course in terms of eternal life. But if you're just, you know, one atom, you know, again something like evolution, that's all you are. One accidental, you know, a combination of genes, you know, pure fate. Then of course, you know, what shall you do? You know, you drink and be merry, tomorrow we die, you can't take it with you. So on. And so the whole fatalism that was very much there.
Or at best, some kind of escapism that they attempted to somehow get out of this circle and to fly off to some realm of contemplation, that at least with your mind would free you from your body that would die. With Christianity, we stress that a lot in the difference between resurrection of the body and at least what the pagans called the immortality of the soul. Of course, we Christians have, you know, gotten used to using those two terms as synonymous, as saying the same thing. But the way the pagans said immortality of the soul, they meant that in contrast to the body. But see, the body was dirt, the body was evil, and the immortality of the soul meant that somehow the soul got out of its prison. You see, and flew off to some never never land. Well, you see, Christianity stresses that the body, you know, will rise as well as the soul. That ultimately, you know, it's all a part of God's creation. That we'll all be redeemed. So, you know, a lot of angles that this could take. Well, I think one other thing that should be stressed here is the whole different idea of worship that was involved in pagan religion. What they mean by all their sacrifices and the like. You know, if the gods have no morality, no purpose, no righteousness, no justice, all these words, of course, that the Bible describes of the true God, you see, if you just have, you know, the blind faith of everyday life, who knows where the lightning is going to strike, what's going to happen tomorrow? You see, if that's the way the gods are, which is the way nature is, no predicting it, really. But then all you can do is try to buy the gods off, bribe them maybe, butter them up enough, so they won't bug you, you see? So they'll get off your back and leave you alone. And that's very much behind what's involved in sacrifice. The idea of bribing the gods, feeding them enough, you know, so they have a full stomach and won't come to take away what you have. Well, that's very explicit in many of the prayers. Sometimes Christians fall into that habit, you know, that their religion is supposed to be some kind of bribe to God. If they do enough or give enough, why, that should impress God, and God better keep his half of the bargain. That pagan thought comes into Christianity enough, but, I mean, that's, of course, we call that wrong. It's not at the heart of it. Or, so much of their worship was basically magic. You know, what's magic? You don't have to have any morality to make magic work. You don't have to have any personal faith. You know, more magic, at least in theory, was sort of a pseudoscience. If you did the right things in the right way, see, then presto, you know, that would happen. All you had to do was have the right hocus pocus, the right actions, and the right mumbo jumbo, you know, the right words, and that would happen. So they thought that their liturgy really kept the world going around. That's partly why. Why their religion and their mythology is so bound up with sexuality and fertility. Because
because you see, if they somehow they didn't prime the pump, why somehow that aspect of the gods would run down or something. And of course then there wouldn't be any life in anymore. So it was a necessity of this constant magic of keeping the world going around all the time. And well, maybe just a couple of other things while we talk about these generalities here. When you talk about creation, of course you talk about something basically permanent. That's why, in their thinking, permanence of politics was very much bound up with the permanence of the mythology, that they thought that the state, the king, had been, you know, that it always had been that way. So that many of these so-called creation stories, really, they're as much as anything concerned to justify the supreme power of Babylon, or the king of Babylon, to justify that king's right to be king. You see, anybody who would rebel against that king was rebelling against God, because it always had been that way. So the politics too was part of the order of creation, part of the way it always had been. In the West, you maybe know that phrase of the divine right of kings. You know, there was a time before democracy became popular that the kings, even in the West, tried to defend themselves by saying that they had a divine right to be king. But somehow God had just ordained that there should be kings. You see, so again, you see, to vote against that king was to vote against God, you know, necessarily, no matter what. That kind of absolutism of the monarchy. And I think, for one thing, that helps one understand what went on in early Israel. Remember how, first, they did not have kings. And you recall how strenuously Samuel resists their attempts to get a king. They had no king, but the true God. And finally, he does relent of his great warnings, which came true many times over, as the whole book of Kings goes on to tell. But you see, part of that was that in the whole world around them, you see, kingship was not just an alternate way of having a government. But there was this whole idea that the kingships, if they were not God, as in Egypt, the pharaohs were thought to be God, period. In Babylon and Canaan, apparently, it wasn't quite that much, but it was in that direction. They were, you know, earthly manifestations of God, visible representatives and incarnations of the God and that kind of thing. What the Book of Kings illustrates. You see, when they got kings, why, they got much of the other baggage that in that world, almost inevitably, came along with kingship. The whole bit of paganism that, you know, that came in throughout the period of all the kings.
Personal power.
Well, I mean, in one sense, that is true. So, I mean, we would understand that we all think that was just their rationalization, and I suppose everybody who has power dreams up his justification for it. But you see, that they could try to appeal to the eternal order of nature, you see, to defend their specific political system. And that's why when one country conquered another, since their religions were so much the same, that just meant that they incorporated the gods of the conquered country into the gods of the other country. Because, you see, they really were the same gods. They just had different names. And so what we know as syncretism, you see, of just borrowing, and this fluidity went so naturally. And see, of course, that's what made the Israelites so hated. But you see, since their god was not that way. When they were conquered, you know, they would not, you know, bow down and just identify Yahweh with Baal. Because Yahweh not only was not Baal, but he was just, you know, radically different from the word go. But if it was just Baal, why, that was just another name for Marduk, the god of Babylon, or Zeus, or Jupiter. You know, take your pick. Basically the same god. And so you see, when the Romans came in New Testament times, well, they kind of superimposed their Greek and Roman names on it, But it was, you know, the same thing that they had had, you know, for who knows how many centuries, and it wasn't all that different. So I mean, in another sense, why this was every bit as much the case in New Testament times yet as it was in the Old.
Well, we were talking about Holy Mountains last time, and I said the Bible talks somewhat that way too. I told you to think of a passage and tell me when you came back in where the Bible does talk that way. Anyone come up with one?
I thought first of Sinai, but then the New Testament talks about Mount Zion. And I guess Psalms 2.
Yeah, okay. Let's just remember that a second. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 11. In general, this is a well-known passage. The first part of this especially, we often talk about one of the messianic prophecies, you know, there's a famous shoot from the stump of Jesse, obviously talking about, you know, the descendant of David, and all of that. Verse 6 is a well-known verse, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and so on. And then we'll look down at verse 9 at the end of this passage. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. Well, there is this holy mountain where the child will play together with the lion and the poisonous snake and all these things.
That's the whole world? Or is that a heaven or eternity?
Yeah, okay. Obviously, this is talking about the fulfillment, the climax, the end of the world in one sense, the new creation. In fact, this verse sort of indicates that it's the end of the world, that it's the whole earth, namely by the fact the way it goes on. Remember, in biblical poetry a lot, especially in the Psalms, the second half of the line says about the first thing as the first half, only a little bit different words. If you don't know what the first half means, read the second half, or vice versa, at least a lot of times. Sometimes you don't know what either one means, but sometimes that's a help. So you notice how this goes on. Parallel to this is, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Well, again, you see the same language, but with a completely different understanding. When mythology talked about the mountain of the gods, it was the whole earth. Indeed, but the gods, you see, were the whole earth. They were part of the earth. In the Bible, of course, God, you know, has created the whole earth. He dwells in it, above it. It was corrupted by sin, but it will be regained. And remember we often forget that. Part of the effect of what God accomplished in Christ is not just the forgiveness of individual sins. We accent that, of course, for obvious reasons. But ultimately, the scope of it is cosmic. It's new creation. Remember our Christmas hymn very soon. Far as the curse is found. You know, and the curse is found everywhere. So it uses the same mountain language. And why? You know, humanly speaking, one might guess that they might not have talked that way. We don't talk that way very much anymore. In fact, we have a little bit of a hard time understanding this. But they talk that way a lot, sort of to meet the competition, you know, to meet the devil where he is. You know, and there's no point in turning your guns and shooting them, you know, where there is no enemy. You turn your guns and shoot them where the enemy is. And meeting the devil, or some people put sometimes even stealing ammunition from the devil to use against himself. Not leave, you know, all the good language to the devil himself. Well, a similar one to this, of the mountain, that is a little clearer, is turn back to Isaiah chapter 2. And I think you know some parts of this passage well. it shall come to pass in the latter days, you know, that's a phrase for, you know, more or less the end of the world that began, in one sense, when Christ came. But the mountain, what mountain? The mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, shall be raised above the hills, and all nations shall come to it. Well, what will they come to? What will they say? Toward the end of verse 3, they say, out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now, where is this mountain? Is this the whole world?
How about Jerusalem?
Yeah, okay. Is it Jerusalem? Are there two different mountains here? Is there, we're talking about a different mountain here than we were in chapter 11? And of course, as Mr. Charlemagne just said, the Bible talks a lot about Mount Zion. The New Testament does too. Anybody want to stick his neck out? Well, you know, what was Mount Zion? Okay.
Sounds more like Christ's kingdom here.
Okay. Very good. In the Old Testament too, this was God's kingdom, right? And Jerusalem, Zion, was the center, the capital of the kingdom. A lot of times you could talk of the whole kingdom in terms of its capital, as we often do today. Washington, you know, Moscow means America, Russia, and so on, part for the whole. And in the fulfillment of it, why, of course, what God started here in the Old Testament, he brought to completion in the Christian church. So we often speak of the Christian church, too, as Mount Zion. Remember one of our hymns? Glorious things of thee are spoken. Zion, city of our God. I don't know what number it is in our hymnal, but it's a fairly well-known hymn. Or the book of Hebrews talks about that all Christians have come to Mount Zion. But in a way, in what was God doing in Mount Zion in the Old Testament? That was, if you will, sort of God's beachhead. That was sort of the beginning of God's recapture of the whole world. So in principle, it was the whole world already. At least it was, you know, there are various ways to put it. It was God's base of operations. He was already doing in Mount Zion what he would do to the whole mountain, to the whole world eventually. As in the church. What's the Christian church? The Christian church is, you know, God's beachhead in the world for the light to shine, for witness, and so on. In principle, you see, the church is already heaven on earth. You know, so total forgiveness of sins now. Rebirth. In principle, it is, you know, that already. In our worship, you know, what do we say? We sing together with angels and archangels. That's pretty poetry. You know, but, you know, we mean that. In principle, it is that already. You see, it's the same mountain. It was Zion, it was Jerusalem. Now, what was the difference from paganism here? In mythology, these mountains always had been holy. You see, it was part of nature, really always the same. It was just that way, you know, morality and all of that, you know, made no difference. All you had to do was recognize it and go through the right magic there, and all of that. But how about Mount Zion? Had that always been that way? No, God, a personal God, you know, made a decision, like people do, to choose that mountain, like he chose Israel. They weren't holy, you know, from eternity. He chose them, he elected them, he predestined them, like us. You see, we don't have a claim on God by some birthright. We like to kid ourselves that we do, but really not, you know. A person chose us, he loved us. He sought us, he won us. You know, we use that language, personal language. So with the church, so with the mountain. You see, it's basically the same, of course, with the New Testament as the Old, but just the language changes a little bit. And in a way, the New Testament is just the same thing on a little higher form. And well, you know, the best part of this passage, while we're at it, is in verse 4. They will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. You know, there won't be any war anymore. This is that famous passage that's on the cornerstone of the UN. Unfortunately, that's sort of a blasphemous use of the Bible, in one sense, you know, because that sort of indicates that this is just men's dreams, you know, something that that men can accomplish through the UN or something else. The Bible here, of course, is talking about the peace of God that passes all human understanding, you know, about a different kind of peace that only God can accomplish. But if you don't misunderstand it, well, of course, it's a nice thought, even in the UN. But you'd better keep a couple things straight. Well, let's look at one other part. I'll turn to the Psalms. There are some psalms that we call Psalms of Zion, or Hymns of Zion, that talk about, you know, what Jerusalem meant as God had elected it, and I just want to look at one of them. Look at Psalm 48. Psalm 48. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, his holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, is the joy of all the earth. Now look carefully. Mount Zion in the far north. What's that mean? Is Zion in the far north? Well, you know, it depends on where you are. You know, if the globe is round, I guess in one sense, well, you know, something is always north of something else. But certainly, you remember our geography from the first... we still have this map here. Is Jerusalem in the far north? Hardly, you know. Jerusalem's down here. And, you know, sort of here's where the desert starts. It's north a little bit, of course, in the southern part of the land. But most of it's north. And, of course, there was... The far north was... You know, way up there. Well, what's this talking about? How is Jerusalem in the far north?
Would maybe have to be that the far north side would be snow-covered and white would stand for holiness, purity?
Well, now that's creative thinking. Yeah, that, of course, that kind of symbolism is found in the Bible a lot. I don't think that's the direct thing involved here. Let me come back to what was the mountain of the gods in paganism? Not Mount Olympus in Canaan, but it was Mount North. And I think what we have here, you see, to us this doesn't communicate because we don't know this language. But here the psalm is saying that the real Mount North, the real mountain of the gods, and of course not of the gods, but of the one true God, is Mount Zion. This is the mountain, you know, where God is working to redeem the whole universe. And remember the people who lived in that age, you know, to who heard all about Mount North in a mythological sense all the time? Well, I see that this would be pretty powerful antidote, pretty powerful correction. It wouldn't have to be explained to them like it does to us. Now, The Bible also sometimes uses this word north in another sense, not applying it to Zion in a good sense then, but since north was, of course, the home of the pagan gods, therefore, in another sense, from a biblical standpoint, it was the home of the devil, right? That's finally, if there's any reality to the false gods, it's, you know, just an expression of the devil. And so north came to indicate in the Bible, you know, the source of evil, the direction from which invasions would come, even God's judgment that he would bring upon the Israelites. And so the Bible often talks mysteriously about the northerner, you know, who will come. Quite a few of the prophets, I don't think we'll take time tonight to look up passages, but there are several of them. And probably that idea, too, of the northerner, you know, is another takeoff, you know, from this idea, but a different kind of one. While we're talking of this, I think one other thing we should talk about, this would overlap with the last time, that what passage we had in Isaiah 2 talked about the house of God in Jerusalem. What's the house of God mean? It means a temple, right? Tabernacle. Place where God really lives. We use that of our churches too, the house of God. Here's language too that the Bible and here the Christians still use. But what's the difference from paganism again? When the pagans talked of their temples as houses of God, you see, really they sort of had nature by the tail, God by the tail, if you will. if they went through the right magic again, you see, and bribed the gods or buttered them up in the right way, you see, that they just, you know, were that way by nature. And they built their houses of God, oh, you know, over springs and sacred trees that they thought always had been holy. But how about our churches? At least if we think of them, right? We sometimes think of them in a pagan way. You know, people talk carelessly about our church. And well, sometimes they draw all kinds of conclusions from that that one isn't always that happy about. So they really do think it's their church to do with, you know, as they please. Or as though, you know, somehow they have God there, and God just had better, you know, keep his part of the bargain. Pagan thought creeps into us too very much. But what about really is it? We say that God is really present in our churches, in a general sense, in general, and of course specifically in the Lord's Supper. In the temple, you know, God is really present. Remember above the mercy seat of the ark between the cherubim? We talked about that in the innermost part of the tabernacle. It was God's house, but again, what was the difference? Well, because, you know, a personal God decided. He elected, he chose that as his house. But it wasn't there by magic, you see. If the Israelites would rebel, well, then, of course, he would forsake it. As long as God was there, it couldn't be destroyed. In fact, Isaiah talks that way a lot, too. Almost as though Jerusalem had a magical guarantee from God that it would never, never be destroyed. And a lot of the Israelites misunderstood it in that way, in a magical sense. As though, come what may. And remember Jeremiah once bawling his people out for saying, the temple of the Lord is with us. You know, nothing will happen. Then, you know, Jeremiah says, well, you go on and lie, kill, steal, and commit adultery, you know, and still you come and save the temple of the Lord, you see. That was a pagan idea. So, you know, what Isaiah was saying is that, you know, in one sense, nothing could happen to the temple as long as God was really there. But if the people abandoned him, then God would abandon them, you know. And of course, then the temple was just another pile of bricks and stone, and then it would be destroyed, as it was when the Babylonians or so on came. The Hebrew word for house is Beth. You know of any biblical names that start with that? Yeah, one of the most famous ones is Bethlehem. And in fact, most of these names were there before the Israelites ever got there. You know, they just kept those names, like, you know, we kept Indian names and that kind of thing. But in most cases, they probably originally meant that there was a temple of the pagan god there. And in fact, in this case, we know that this isn't a very, you know, major god. But there was a god, a Canaanite god by this name. It was a god of war and sex, you know, all these things got mixed up usually. But we know this god, so plainly this name comes from this. How do we explain the name Bethlehem? Here's a good example how you keep the same name, but you see the Bible Christians will, you know, give it a different understanding because, of course, we don't believe in a God by that name. Anyone know how you'll hear it a lot with Christmas coming up? How do we usually explain Bethlehem? Well, yeah, sure, but I mean, what the meaning of the name itself?
Oh.
Well, this is the Hebrew word for bread. You've heard this, the house of bread. You see, the bread of life was born there. Every once in a while, you hear a sermon on that theme. And, you know, that's what the word does mean. But you see, in paganism, this was, you know, sort of the god bread, the god who gave bread, the god of fertility, of life. You see that idea? Well, you see, in the Bible, of course, well, you know, there is only one God who gives bread, who gives life. And, of course, with Christ being born there, well, of course, in a much fuller sense. So you keep the name, but you understand it differently. And you stop and think the Bible is just full of names that start with Beth. You look in any Bible dictionary or so on. And nearly all of them, you know, originally, were names of temples of one god or the other. Beth Shemesh, where the ark was. Shemesh is the Hebrew word for sun. And there must have been a temple to the sun god there at some time or another. There was a Beth Yerach, you know, a temple of the moon. The list is almost endless. But they say, yeah, you know, we forget, you know, we hear these names because we don't know Hebrew either, so they don't tell anything. But in those days, you can see how, you know, for in that world where everybody knew this language, we see the very names could very easily be a snare to mislead them. But they could be a cue for the right understanding, for the right explanation. But you see, the whole battle between the two religions would go on about how you'd hear those names and understand them all the time. Well, let's turn to something else. Eel had a wife. Yeah, please. Yeah.
One quick question. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a reference to, instead of up north, it says of Zaphon or Zaphon.
Well, okay.
What do they mean by that?
The Hebrew word for north is Zaphon.
It doesn't refer to a city then.
Well, you see, talking Hebrew, you wouldn't say Mount North, you'd say Mount Zaphon. You see, it's the same word, just in the Hebrew language. So I didn't talk Hebrew to you, I talked English to you. So the footnote there is just telling you what technically in that language the name was, that's all. Okay? Okay, now had a wife, or a consort, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell just whether they were married or not. But her name was, anyone happen to know? Was Asherah. Ever hear of it?
Yes.
Is she ever mentioned in the Bible?
They had pillars to her or something like that in the temple.
All right. Okay. Well, this name is mentioned. I don't have the figure at my fingers' tips, but I would guess 50 plus times in one form or another. Again, in the English translations, it's not always obvious, but it's there. Let's turn to, let's see, what else do I want for you here? To Exodus 34, Exodus 34, verse 13. This is one of the earliest times that it's mentioned. This is in a list of laws that's there. God says, you shall tear down their altars, break their pillars, and cut down there. Now, you may find something different here if you have the different versions. The RSV has their Asherim, with an I-M at the end instead of an A-H. Any of you have a different translation or something else?
I have Rome.
Oh, you have King James?
Right.
All right, very good. I wanted someone to have that.
I have Sacred Poles.
Sacred Poles. Okay, well, what translation do you have?
NEV.
NEV, yeah, okay. All right. Well, these are mentioned many times in the Bible, all through the Book of Kings. Wherever paganism comes in, these are mentioned, and, you know, whenever they're a reformation, they're thrown out. Whenever the Bible talks about high places and the worship, the pagan worship that went on there, these things are mentioned. Now, the RSV, you know, kind of keeps the Hebrew word itself, but, you know, who knows what that means. King James has groves, but, you know, who knows what that should mean in this setting. Sacred pools, maybe. Well, what these, we don't know exactly what these were, but they were apparently wooden pillars of some sort, or poles. Whether they were carved in the form of statues or whatnot isn't entirely clear. But there were obviously an awful a lot of them. And you see, they represented this female god. They were made of wood, obviously, because the Bible talks about, you know, sawing them, burning them, the kind of thing that, you know, you couldn't do with stone or with metal. So here they're supposed to be cut down. And see, when the King James was translated, of course, we didn't know about this really until archaeology. And even now we don't know all about it, but we know a little bit more. They were just, you know, a faint memory that had, you know, been handed down through the ages. And so the translation groves comes from that. You can see how it's a near miss.
It's close, but it wouldn't quite ring the right bells, because groves, we think, of course, of living
well,
trees.
Well, it could look like a grove of
trees. In one sense, a bunch of wooden pillars, yeah. But apparently there weren't living trees, so. So it's a near miss, and of course, if you know what it really was, why, groves might not be bad. But to the ordinary reader, who doesn't have any background, at least, why, it wouldn't I'd say much. Well, the RSV is better by saying Asherim. Of course, it's debatable, too, but nobody knows what that is.
You can say grove with a bunch.
Yeah, well, surely, at least for us.
There are a lot of trees,
and there are a lot of poles. Yeah, right. And so the Bible, this Asherah here, this God, she was sort of the original mother goddess. She's the goddess of sex and fertility. And you know, the biblical descriptions of what went on every high hill and under every green tree, this refrain in the Bible. These are fertility rites, the sacral prostitution, you see, that was supposed to be sort of a magic, you know, that would keep fertility going in the whole realm of nature, so on. You know, obviously, they're very popular. One, you know, doesn't have to think too hard to realize that a man might not be very religious in general, who might find, you know, this kind of religion, you know, rather attractive in its own way. At Corinth, even in Paul's time, Paul talks about God's many and then Lord's many. There's a big mountain citadel above Corinth called Acro-Corinth. And we know from Greek sources of that time that there were upward of 1,000 sacral prostitutes, you know, that were employed up there permanently in a big seaport, you know, like Corinth was. So, you know, that type of thing that went on even in New Testament times, you know, part of Paul's antithesis. Oh, and she just mentioned all over the place in the Bible. But this is just one, to cut down their Asherim. Now, let's back up a couple of words. First, it says to break their pillars. Now, I don't know, what do you have in some of the other translations? Same
images,
thing.
Images.
What?
Images.
Sacred pillars. Sacred pillars, yeah. Well, that says a little bit what it was. Here, you know, just so you see what it is, the Hebrew word here is... Matzeh Bah, we pronounce it. It's not an ordinary pillar. It's a special word. And you know, see here, the RSV even didn't say Matzeh Bah, because that wouldn't go say anything at all. They just said pillars. But what are pillars? They're not ordinary pillars. These were made of stone, and they sort of represented the male principle in the sexuality of the fertility religion. Asherah was the wife, the mother, and here the stone pillar. Canaanite temples very often had a huge stone pillar right in the front, just before the entrance. From archaeology now, why we know them very well, Shechem, where I spent a couple of summers, why we found one. And we struggled one whole summer to get that re-erected and set up again, so it'll look a little bit like it once had in biblical times. It is a pillar, but again, you know, the word pillar doesn't nearly explain all that the Bible has in mind with that. Now, while we're on this context, you know, if we just look on in this context to how this goes on, in contrast to that in Exodus 34, and you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous. You know, we have problems with that word jealous sometimes, God being called jealous. But if you're aware that this is, you know, correcting a wrong sexual image, you know, basically here you have the idea of God as the husband, you know, who is jealous in a good sense, who is not about to share his wife with somebody else. You know, there's something wrong if anybody's willing to do that. So, but you see, against the background of pagan religion, you can see why particularly you would talk about God as jealous in contrast to the amoral or immoral pagan gods. And then the language goes on in verse 16, or verse 15 already, about, you know, playing the harlot after their gods. Or in the King James, that's often translated to go a-whoring after other gods. You see, that wasn't just figurative speech. That was, you know, all too concrete and real in the religion and activities of that time. Well, we're in this connection, let's turn to verse 26 of the same chapter.
way at the end of verse 26. We have a command from God there, not to do what? You shall not boil a kid, that is, a baby goat, in its mother's milk. Now, who in the world would want to boil a kid in its mother's milk to begin with? In fact, this command is repeated two other times in the Bible, in other, groups of laws. So it was, pretty important that God went to the trouble of repeating it three times. What's behind this? Well, we were really, just didn't have a clue until archaeology helped us a little bit. It's very interesting, if any of you have Jewish friends, the Jewish tradition made some sense out of this in one way. It surely wasn't what it meant originally, but their interpretation of it was, anyone know? One of the basic kosher laws, as you may know, is that they can't have meat and milk dishes together. And for that reason, a lot of Orthodox Jews keep a separate set of dishes for cooking them. Or, you go to an Orthodox Jewish restaurant, you can't fit, milk in your coffee unless you have a vegetarian meal. Of course, today they can get around that by using meal powder or some of that kind of stuff. But at least originally you couldn't. And see, they got that out of this passage. You see, they generalized from not having, the meat of a kid in milk to not mixing meat or milk ever. No, that's fanciful, that's silly. That's not what this passage is talking about at all, but I think that is of interest of how the Jews did at least make some sense out of this passage. Whereas Christians were on and had no idea whatsoever what this was all about. We know now from mythology, at least in a general way, what this was. Because apparently this was a well-known fertility rite in paganism. In fact, specifically, it was supposed to be sort of a magical cure for impotence. Plays a pretty prominent role in some of the mythological stories. Apparently it was pretty popular in that time. And so you see, nothing wrong with boiling a kid in its mother's milk to begin with, if you want to be silly enough to do that. But you see, in the pagan context of that time, why, it would have been, anybody who would do that would obviously be marking himself as obviously, belonging to the religion and the whole fertility and everything that was bound up with that. And you see, here, there, just could be no compromise at all. There could be no earthly reason why anybody would want to boil a kid in its mother's milk, indeed, if he didn't believe in this magical rite. And so this was tempting enough. Just one symptom, of course, of the whole problem, but one that must have been popular enough that it's repeated two other times besides this in the Bible. You see, this type of thing probably explains a lot of other things, like which animals were unclean, they couldn't eat pork, and all these other laws. Obviously, various things are mixed up in those laws. It's not always one explanation. But sometimes the same thing applies in a lot of other cases. But at least humanly speaking, part of why something is forbidden or something is unclean, is because they were holy to the pagans. And it wasn't because there was anything bad about those animals or whatnot as such. It was just that, to separate the people of God from paganism. And the almost inevitable way in which it would be misunderstood, at best, if the Israelites ate that meat or whatever it was. Could you raise your hand?
I just ran across a note that just says that this was a Canaanite custom known from the Rosh Hashanah text.
Yeah, Rosh Hashanah. Yeah, we talked about it last time. Ugarit is another name for that. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, in fact, we have the whole ritual in quite some detail there. It's one of the more lurid, X-rated stories from Ugarit. So we don't know exactly how the Canaanites understood this, but we get the general picture pretty plainly now, as if we didn't understand it before. Well, that's just one example of this kind of thing. Well, now Eli and Ashua, they have kids, of course. 70, using the same symbolism that the Bible does. Seven, sort of a symbol of completeness. And 70, 7 times 10, you see, is more than enough. Some of that's symbolic.
But one of their best known children is the name, and this one I'm sure you know, of course, namely our friend Baal. Now, in practice, Baal was sort of the grandfather of the gods. He had sort of been kicked upstairs. He was sort of the honorary figure. He didn't really cut any ice. Whenever the other gods went to do something, well, it was sort of out of respect, you know, they went and got his permission, but you know, he better not say no, you know, sort of that situation. The real head of the gods was Baal, and that's why Baal, of course, is mentioned all over the place in the Bible, because he was the real actor, and he was the real competitor, you know, the true god, in most of the Bible. But Baal isn't really a name either. Baal is a title. You know, something like Christ. And of course, we easily confuse them. Jesus is the name. Christ, of course, is just a title, the Messiah, the anointed one. So Baal is just his title. But as with Christ, you know, he was often, you know, called by that so much so that we hardly know his name. What Baal means is Lord. Well, you know, like in English, you can spell Lord with a small L, or you can spell it with a capital L. Same word. And so Baal was an ordinary word for Lord on earth. In fact, sometimes in the Bible, in early times, even the true God is called Baal. You know, not with a capital B, if you will. Of course not. But he's Lord. We call him Lord, too. Why not? He's the only real Lord, no matter how many other lords there may be. Remember, even Paul of Corinth, you know, says there were gods many and lords many, but at least the Corinthians worshipped. In fact, we see that from one of their names. The name of Saul's son, that reigned for a little bit over part of the country after Saul died, had the name of Ish, that is the Hebrew for man, that is the man of a worshiper of Ish. Ish Baal, Ish Baal. And Saul had his problems, you know. But Saul wasn't the worshiper of the Canaanite religion. Saul, you know, plainly, at least in theory, belonged to the true God. Plainly, Saul means to call his son, you know, a boy, a worshiper of the Lord, in the good sense. There are other indications of this. Now again, you see, our translations don't usually bring that out, and you know, it takes a lot of explanation. If you have a good bunch of footnotes in the Bible, well, you know, it might explain it for you. Well, you see, you know, what a problem this was for them. In fact, before we leave this word Baal, one other thing should be said. Baal, another meaning of this word Baal, can be, very often was, husband. Now, you know, women livers won't like this idea at all. But at least especially in that culture, you know, the husband was Lord. Or at least, you know, he probably could get by with a little more of it than he can today. And you see, that would apply to the pagan religion too. You see, where of course the gods, you know, got married. Unlike the true God. So that part fit them very directly. Of course, in that sense, it's not applied to the true God because it just doesn't fit, of course. The true God doesn't get married, so of course they couldn't apply it that way. But there is another application of this. Did you ever hear of Beulerion? Of Beulerion? There was a Negro spiritual by that name. It comes from one of the prophecies of Isaiah. Well, I think you can see there's some close connection between Baal and Beulah. All Beulah means is married, in effect, you know, lorded, if you will, one that, you know, has a lord, has a husband, married. Why is it called Beulah land? Well, this is in the partly a picture of returning the Israelites from the exile. You see, the exile, the land has been unmarried, uninhabited, desolate, you know, while they're in exile.
when they return from the captivity, you see the land will again be married, it'll be fertile, it'll have many children. And remember, Paul even uses this language in Galatians 4, the Christian church, you know, quoting Isaiah. If you recall, I don't want to take time though, but if you don't believe me, well, look it up in Galatians 4 when you get home. You see, we've got through the church, God has many children, you know, properly understood, of course, so to speak. That God, you know, makes fertility out of infertility through the gospel and so on, using that picture language. Well, just some of what's involved with that.
We know what Baal's real name was. He had a name, but it's mentioned sometimes in the Bible, but not very much. And maybe you know this, namely Hadad. Does that ring a bell to anyone? Think of anybody in the Bible that has this in their name?
There was a king.
That's right, the kings of Syria. Remember, Syria was still part of the same country, same religion, basically. The kings of Syria had the name of Ben-Hadad. And in Hebrew, Ben means son of Hadad, child of this god. Or another king had the name, they put it on the end, Hadad-Ezer, like Ebenezer in the Bible. Hadad is my help. So, you know, that's mentioned in the Bible too, but it's mostly in names of people who worship that God. So we know that God very, very well. Well, you know, that one could go on with this type of thing a long time. Maybe one other thing we have time to look at. In paganism, since basically the story was that of the battle between life and death that always went back and forth between remember in their season, something like in California, when the rain stopped in the spring, well, that meant death for the grass and, you know, everything except, you know, larger trees and stuff. They pictured that, of course, of Baal being killed every spring by the god Death, by the god Mot in Hebrew. And then every fall, when the rain started up again and everything greened up, then somehow Baal resurrected from the dead, got out of the underworld, came back to life. You see, it was just nature what went on every year, but just told in the story form. But sometimes death, or the power of evil, is described in terms of a monster who swallows up life. And then somehow, you know, life gets out, you know, half a year later always. Because you go around and around. Well, what is the name of this monster? There's quite various things in the Bible. And I think at least one you probably will recognize right away, namely Leviathan. Leviathan. Or he's called other names. Sometimes he's called Rahab. Mind you, this has no connection with the Rahab at Jericho, with the prostitute there. It's a different word in Hebrew. It sounds alike in English, but no connection at all. It's a different word. He's called other things, but I think it'd be these two. He's called the dragon. Now, you know, what's this have to do with the Bible? Sometimes the Bible uses this language to talk of the true God defeating the devil, in effect. Satan. You see, in one sense, it's worlds different. Remember, in paganism, this went round and round every year. Nobody ever really won. Death won in the spring, and life won in the fall. Around and around it went forever. Well, of course, in the Bible, you know, particularly when Christ rose from the dead, why, of course, death was defeated once and for all. And in principle, the devil has been defeated, of course. Even though, you know, he has a little time. But in principle, you know, it's all over. But still, this language can be used to talk of the devil, of the monster of evil, of the monstrosity of evil, of the incalculable power of evil that no man will be a match for.
And so you have this language taken from mythology, no longer understood like mythology did, but used in a way, something like some of these other words. Well, you see, if for them, that would, you know, for people in that day, that would really, really communicate that the real monster of evil was not, you see, in the pagan sense of just a name for the rains coming or going, but of course, you know, it was the devil and, you know, and all of that, the way the Bible, of course, understands God's competition, if you will.